solar digesters in India, wind power in other parts of the world. There are all kinds of recycled examples. It's not like we're dealing with untested theory here. What we're dealing with is a proliferation of successful, sustainable economic technologies that have very little political power and financial power behind them to drive them. And so we can show all over North America how organic agriculture is working on grain farms, not just in little gardens. It's working on grain farms in the Midwest. They're making money. They don't have to spend so much on fertilizer or pesticides or herbicides or occupational hazards, but not all that many farms. The addiction to chemical agriculture, to short-range assurances by the chemical companies to the farmers on 5 a.m. radio in rural America, that they've got to buy, they've got to put more on because the locusts are coming, the fungi is coming. You got to do it now. You got to be able to pay the bank off. It gets worse and worse. Look at the result. We now are losing a larger share of our agricultural crops in 1998 than we lost in 1940, even though the amount of herbicides and pesticides is up over 1,000-fold. There's still a larger loss. And why? Obviously why. Resistance. The Colorado beetle has mutated into resistance against almost anything the chemical industry can throw at it. And parasites. And fungi. If we ever had an international convention of parasites and fungi and insects, they would laugh at us. They say, there's nothing you can do to stop us. Nothing. We multiply too fast. Those of you who know anything about the history of malaria control, when DDT came on, it had such a spectacular effect. In the late 50s, people were saying malaria is going to be eradicated. There's only one thing that didn't quite get the news. It was the mosquito and the parasites. And they became very, very able to resist DDT. And malaria is now spreading more rapidly than in the last 40 years. And 2 to 2.5 million people die every year from malaria. And it was slated by infectious disease specialists for eradication, virtual eradication, by the late 50s. So what we're talking about here is power. The technological answers are way ahead of the civic and political power to displace the destructive technologies that we are being exposed to. Power. Civic power, political power, consumer power, entrepreneurial power. There's a book that came out about 3 years ago called Green Gold. It was full of examples where companies made money doing the right thing by way of environmentally benign technology. One gets almost tired of seeing these examples because if they are good examples, what are the barriers to their expansion? What's interesting is this, that with few exceptions, these companies that are described in this book are smaller companies. They're not the big items. I say with few exceptions because a graduate student back in the early 70s did a test of Great Lakes water for his thesis, and he found that the fish were contaminated with mercury. One would think any number of corporate and governmental laboratories would have determined that, but relied on this graduate student. This created an uproar, and Dow Chemical announced that they were no longer going to dump their mercury into the Great Lakes because it was cheaper to recycle it than to buy more mercury. Wow, what a discovery. I wonder what genius found that out in Dow Chemical. And indeed, they decided that maybe there are other chemicals that is cheaper to recycle than to keep buying from their suppliers. See how primitive toilet training is in corporate America? At any rate, notice, if you will, that the large corporations are the ones that are very often lagging beyond the small companies that are showing the way. And sometimes they just buy them up. For instance, the solar photovoltaic industry in the 70s was largely bought up by the oil companies. Atlantic Richfield bought up a solar company, and the moment they bought it up, the solar company's press releases stopped. They used to say, new breakthrough, new sale, new application. They bought it up, it stopped, and then a few years later they sold it to a German company, which now operates it. Now, we had 80% of our solar photovoltaic capacity in this country, the production capacity, was owned by the oil companies by 1985. That's an example of global corporations in the way, standing in the way. Now, you can spend a lot of time trying to regulate them, trying to counteract the effect of money and politics that they put into the politicians' coffers. You can spend a lot of time trying to litigate against them in the courts. They have all kinds of corporate lawyers, and their costs are deductible. You can spend a lot of time condemning them and shaming them in the community. There's now in the U.S. a national toxic control inventory system where you can call up the Environmental Protection Agency in your community and get a printout of which its facilities are emitting what kind of chemicals. They're now expanding the number of chemicals that have to be reported. And the mere publication of this has shamed some of the companies to cut back. Because, you know, you become viewed at the country club, you're a dirty emitter. Whatever reason you will take for them to clean up, it did work to some degree. The best approach, however, is the philosophy based on a long-range respect for future generations that highlights prevention and displacement of technology. These industries, petrochemical industry, for example, have to be displaced. You're simply not going to be able to control them. You have to look at the end uses. What are they producing the product for? What use? Can that use be met with another kind of product? Can it be substituted? Let me just give you a rather simple example. Arsine gas is one of the most toxic gases that industry produces. When there was a shipment of arsine gas a few years ago through Pennsylvania to be loaded on a ship heading for Cherbourg in France, there was a slight accident. And it was revealed that if this container had completely disintegrated and all the arsine gas had gone out, it could have wiped out Pennsylvania. Now, let's assume, and this is just a hypothetical, okay? Let us assume this arsine gas was part of complex chemistry that produced plastic swivel sticks for people's drinks, you know, martinis and so on. We would look at the end use analysis and say, plastic swivel sticks. All these chemicals being produced in Galveston and Texas City and Niagara Falls and so on. Some of this is going into plastic swivel sticks. Is this an important product that would warrant that kind of backup contamination from the workplace to the environment? If it is an important product, is there a better way to produce it? That's the kind of flow analysis we've got to make to bring us to our senses. It's like the CFC aerosol. Imagine depleting the global air, ozone because we cannot substitute our thumb, or now there is a more benign chemical, not entirely, that will be the propulsive force behind this treasured aerosol. The other approach, of course, is a more fundamental preventive approach, such as solar energy, organic agriculture, hydrogen-powered automobiles, more mass transit, and a whole host of other things that we have all seen in these paperbacks with the lists of what we can do. It comes down now to consumer habit. What is the role of the consumer? They go to the supermarket with a plastic bag. They get their plastic bag full of goodies, and then they throw away the plastic bag. Or they go away with a paper bag, and they keep returning the paper bag. Or they go with some organic textile bag, which lasts for years. And they keep at it. What about consumer behavior here? How much can it play? First of all, if you can practice what you preach, you can preach more forcefully what you practice. So on that point of view, if you want to sensitize people, don't only give them a world view and a power structure view and with some organizing principles like redefining productivity, redefining economic growth, redefining the link between energy, economic growth, redefining efficiency, but also to develop systems right at the municipal level that will encourage people not only to be responsible in terms of their waste products, in terms of what they buy, to try to encourage pre-cycling before recycling. Recycling is the last stage, rather pre-cycling. You don't use the materials in the first place that are in the stores, but also it's a great educational device, and that's why a lot of children are educating their parents. They go to the schools, they learn about recycling, they learn about pollution, then they go home and they get on their parents, the same way with tobacco control. Now, here is where a city like Montreal can take the lead. You have the highest aspirations of any metropolitan area I've ever seen. Your mayor is saying that Montreal will become the environmental capital of the hemisphere. Now, you may think this is high-flown rhetoric, but do you know something? All progress starts with rhetoric. The key thing is to make it turn into practice. But I'll tell you, in Washington, we'd almost settle for the rhetoric. There is no rhetoric. There is no rhetoric. Washington is a decaying capital with infant mortality double that of the national average, higher than Jamaica, Cuba, and Bulgaria. It has horrible poverty. 40% of the children live in poverty in Washington, D.C., one of the highest average national incomes, personal incomes, average in the country. 40% live in poverty. The average in the U.S. is 25%. I think Canada is less than 10%. The Netherlands is less than 2%. And when they tell us about how our economy couldn't be better and how it's growing, they are using their yardsticks of corporate profits and stock market prices, etc. Whereas the most important single economic statistic in my book is the rate of child poverty. You see what happens when we let them control the yardsticks instead of us having our own yardstick? When Clinton went to the G7 summit in Denver with the other Western European countries and Japan, he strutted with great pride, saying to these other countries, you better follow us. We're way ahead of you. We've got lower unemployment, although the yardstick is very dubious in the way they measure it. He says, and our economic growth is higher, and we're number one in computer software and all the rest of it. And I envisioned the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, who's not one of the G7, just being there to visit and coming up to George Ronald Clinton and saying, Mr. Clinton, President Clinton, I just heard how you're just so proud of your U.S. economy. You think that we should emulate you. May I ask some questions? I'm just not quite fully knowledgeable. And Bill Clinton says, why, sure. What do you want to know? And the Prime Minister says, well, what is the rate of your child poverty? Ours is less than 2%. Why are 80% of your workers losing ground in the last 25 years in terms of inflation-adjusted wages? And how come you're running these huge trade deficits? And why is it you have so many homeless people? And how come you don't have universal health insurance? And why don't you have enough money to repair your crumbling schools so that in Washington, D.C., as we speak, the school year has been deferred for the third time in 5 years for 3 weeks before they open because of fire hazards and crumbling buildings? What do you think Bill Clinton would have said? What do you think Bill Clinton would have said? He'd have headed for McDonald's. That's what he would have done. That's the difference. So back to the consumer habit. Now, at Brown University, a few years ago, they started a program called Brown is Green. And the idea was to analyze, and there was a Department of Environmental Studies, and students were doing this for course credit, every pattern of consumption on campus, chemicals used in laboratories. Now they have a way, which probably is here too, you might want to check. The old way of chemistry lab experiments is being replaced by something called microscale, where they use 2% of the chemicals that we used to use in our chem lab experiments and have less waste disposal and less exposure to the students. Do you use microscale? You do. Okay. They analyze the shower flows in their dormitories, the lighting, the heating, the garbage disposal, and they basically try to, roll it back, recycling, changing what they buy, cutting water waste. And they gave dollar figures to this, several hundred thousand dollars in hot water bills were reduced and so on. Now, I know you're doing something here, I would assume. At least I got some preliminary feedback, although you got a tough building to start with from that point of view. But if you want to write to Brown University, just write Brown is Green Project, Brown University, Providence, Long Island, and I'm sure they'll be happy to send you the material. Tufts College in Massachusetts is also in the lead in that respect. The point is, of course, is that once you live this kind of environmentalism, you're going to be a much more knowledgeable and forceful advocate from the grassroots all the way to the corporate suites. Now, knowledgeable means that there are new tools, new assets to put to work here. One of my favorite is government procurement. The government is the biggest customer, single customer, of products ranging from building materials to paper to fuel to who knows what. They purchase in the United States, the local, state, federal government, $1 trillion worth of products every year. Everything from pharmaceuticals to automobiles. Now, if the customer is always right, because the customer has the leverage, how can we turn government purchasing practices to buy more post-consumer content, paper, to buy more fuel-efficient vehicles? In other words, to begin setting the specifications for displacement technologies that will gain civilian markets. So that where you and I would say to General Motors, I want to buy a 50-mile-a-gallon car, they'll tell you, get lost. But if the U.S. government and the local governments who buy 150,000 cars a year or more say that, you know, it may have a different impact, if not on General Motors, on some smaller auto manufacturer. Now, we succeeded in doing this in auto safety. The way we broke through in auto safety is before the federal auto safety law was passed in 66, we got the Congress to order the General Services Administration in Washington, which buys for the federal government, to require that the cars they buy for federal employees to travel around in had to have seatbelts. They had to have certain safety features that we knew that the auto companies had. They couldn't say, well, we haven't invented them yet, or they're impractical. And we did the same thing with airbags. Couldn't get the auto companies to stop opposing the Department of Transportation to require installations of airbags. So we got the Federal Auto Purchasing Agency, the GSA, to say they wanted to buy 5,500 airbags for starters, and who would bid on it? Well, GM knew what was coming, so they didn't bid. And Chrysler knew it was coming because they knew that it was 55 this year. It's going to be more next year. And then pretty soon other people outside of government say, why can't we buy airbag-equipped cars? And Ford bid. Ford broke ranks, bid, largely because they had a vice president they imported from Britain who didn't go for this deregulation stuff as much as the executives in Detroit. Never underestimate the impact of one or two executives in a company. Allstate Insurance was a great promoter of airbags back in the 70s because of one man, Arch Bow, the CEO, who believed that was a way to keep their claims down and save lives at the same time. When he left, Allstate became like other insurance companies. These are autocratic institutions, which means that the people at the top can turn these companies around. They don't have to go through some sort of massive consultation process. They can turn them around. Maybe they can't stop their employees from playing computer games during office time. But when it comes to technological decisions, they can turn around on a dime. There's a certain benefit to this kind. You turn their autocratic hierarchical system into a benefit by putting a lot of heat on the top CEO and the president. But at any rate, government procurement is now considered an exceptional tool. The Department of Defense, as I mentioned, we can get them to buy photovoltaics. The government is now buying more post-consumer content recycled paper. They buy 2% of all the paper in the United States. They're not called bureaucrats for nothing. Now, it's interesting. When the White House in 1993 wanted to set a tougher standard, possibly chlorine-free, possibly 25% post-consumer content. Now, mind you, this was not a regulation that covered all the paper companies. The paper companies went berserk. They fought the White House on this as if it was a regulation. What does that tell you? It tells you that once you can break through with a purchasing specification by a government agency or administration, it can become the norm very quickly. It can become what regulation would want it to become much more quickly without all the judicial delay and all the harassment these companies can throw against these beleaguered regulatory agencies. In fact, the opposition was so strong that Clinton did not move into any other area in terms of purchasing specifications, even though we laid it out for him, had meetings with Gore, who understood it, it's part of reinventing government, etc. They were stopped cold. Now, this is a strategy for environmental groups, for citizen groups. It's a strategy for your university. Check over their purchasing practices. What kind of cleaning chemicals do they buy? What kind of paper do they buy? What kind of fuel do they buy? With electricity deregulation, we will be able to specify the source of the fuel that we want to buy, which is another lever that we have. Of course, these other tools are not to be disregarded. Regulation is still important. Competition is still important. Government aid to entrepreneurial innovators is important. Using the courts is important. There are major class actions in the United States against mass torts, as they call it, mass pollution torts. We're now seeing a growing minority rebellion against environmental racism, something we all knew, but because we didn't live in these areas, we never really raised a banner. It occurred to me some years ago that the most polluting institutions, the most polluting firms in the country happen to be situated where poor people live, where minorities live. I've yet to see a belching industrial plant in Scarsdale, New York, or Belmont, Massachusetts, or Beverly Hills, California. And that is a whole new source of energy, which we're going to see in a conference next month by Lois Gibbs, who came out of the struggle in Love Canal, Niagara Falls, who's organized the National Clearinghouse Against Hazardous Waste. She's bringing in thousands of community group leaders who get up and announce victories. They don't just bewail. They have fought and won. They have blocked incinerators, closed them down. They've stopped a lot of things around the country because it's so urgent for them. They see their kids getting sick, breaking out in rashes, leukemia, etc. And they're told by corporate epidemiologists, don't worry, there's no evidence that there's a connection here, but they don't believe them. And they're not going to wait until these corporate types are re-educated or find out the exact cause and effect. But they see it all around them, and they have their own epidemiological evidence that this stuff is not exactly healthy for the children. And you know what's coming out of this environmental racism movement is that the ultimate standard for all toxics should not be adults. It should be children and infants. There's a book out by John Wargo, Yale University Press. He teaches at Yale, W-A-R-G-O, called Our Childhood Toxic Legacy. And it is the most astute and accurate and balanced condemnation of herbicides, pesticides, and other toxics. This man knows his stuff. And that is the single most important environmental book to come out since Silent Spring. And it didn't go anywhere. It was hardly reviewed. And one of the points he makes in a very sophisticated and detailed matter is that children, because of their tissue development, because they often consume products per body weight far greater than the adult. For example, apple juice, children, old children drink far more apple juice per body weight. Infants, much more vulnerable to toxics than adults. Much more vulnerable. Lead, for example. Something like 28% of all children in the U.S. have dangerous levels of lead in their body. Many of them Hispanics and African Americans. Imagine a society that brags about its world-class technology, and it's known about lead-based paint crumbling off tenement walls in our cities for decades, and newspapers have put page one stories for decades, and we haven't been able to mobilize getting rid of the lead-based paint on our tenement walls. But we're to the moon. We're looking at Saturn. We've got all kinds of technologies operating here. Software, hardware, genetic engineering. We don't know how to scrape. so it doesn't get into the room, get it out, or contain it some way. Should be a big jobs program in the inner city. Big public works program. Competently done. And this raises the compelling point that Barry Commoner makes, which is that environmental strategies are employment strategies. The idea that people are being told that if you have environmentalism, you have fewer jobs. It's jobs or the environment. It's complete and total nonsense, as well as a cruel corporate strategy.